In the early chapters of Genesis, we find people living to 5, 6, 7, 8, and even 900 years and above. Have you ever thought that was kind of strange? I know I certainly have. Alex, what about you?
Yeah, it's a little strange. I mean, I'm trying to get to 250, but I doubt I'll get there. So, yes, 900. What's the highest that we have in the Bible? 967, I think.
969, I think.
It's somewhere around there. So,
yeah,
no spring chicken, that's for sure.
Methuselah. Yeah, Methuselah.
Yes, Methuselah.
960 something years old. Pretty wild. So, yeah, this is another really and this one hits you right away, right? This is a strange one in the Bible that's just
very strange.
Boy, if you're a new believer, you don't know anything about Christianity, and you weren't raised up in any kind of church context or anything, you're a teenager maybe, right? And you're starting to read the Bible for the first time ever. You go get on page 5 before you start seeing, whoa, wait a minute.
And before we even get in this conversation, because it could go so many different ways, but whether you think the earth is young or you think the earth is old, this is strange for, I think, everyone involved. So yes. Let's just get that out on the table. So we're all on the same page there.
Yeah. That's a great point. One thing is for sure here. The text says what it says. Now, Does the text mean what it says? And in what sense does the text mean what it says? Okay, that's the interpretive question. That's the question that ultimately we're going to be talking through. Mm-hmm. But the text says what it says. And this one is very, very hard for anybody to even attempt to escape, right? I mean, it's kind of like when people, there's all kinds of ages, okay? But let's just go with the worst case scenario. Let's say Methuselah, right? Okay, Methuselah is, this guy's 969 years old, right? And so it's kind of like when people say, well, how could God allow bad things to happen? How could God, order the what some would call, I would disagree with this terminology, but what some would call the genocide of these Canaanite tribes and peoples and everything? And it's like, well, why are we talking about that? Well, let's go back to Genesis 6-8. Let's go talk about the flood, where literally everything except Noah and his family was destroyed. Okay. Let's deal with the worst case scenario and see, is this something that we can actually deal with? Okay. Yeah. So can we deal with a 969-year-old man? Well, so there's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack, okay? There's sort of the biblical side. There's the science side, sort of the archaeology side. One just sort of glaring thing that we have to notice is that we don't have any evidence of anyone who ever lived that long. We just don't have it, okay? Yep. If anything, based on our archaeological studies that we've done, ancient people in general seemed to live shorter, right? And actually had shorter lifespans, certainly not longer. Now, gosh, as I'm talking, I've got a long list in front of me of notes that we've taken. And as I'm talking, I can't even believe this, but literally more notes are just flooding into my brain here. So here we are again with another 2-hour long, 20-minute episode, I feel like. But
yes.
So there's a lot here. So obviously we don't have evidence that people lived this long. But we also might not expect to have evidence of people who lived this long. For example, if we take the biblical timeline seriously, we seem to have a drastic and pretty fast moving cutoff of these ages after the flood, right? Okay. And so the flood, when you just think common sense about the order of things that would have been buried, of course, we don't exactly know how many humans were living on the earth at this time. There are some estimates that different people have tried to do, but there's so many assumptions that go into that. It's not even funny. And so at number one, we don't know how many people of these grand ages we should really even expect to find in something like an ancient fossil record. And if you consider the fact that humans would have, for very obvious reasons, been sort of the last to be buried by a flood, because they would have escaped to the high ground and then even if they were out there before the floodwaters had fully rose up and taken them over, they probably would have been scavenged by animals looking to find food. There's just very little expectation, again, dealing with the biblical history on its merits, there's just very little expectation that we would actually expect to find a lot of very ancient human fossils, or frankly, any human fossils from around that time. So this is one that, in my opinion, they kind of, to use a pun here, flood, whatever, they kind of wash each other out, okay? So there's this negative piece of evidence that we don't find any, but then there's this positive piece of evidence that's kind of like, well, it would actually be quite rare. Like, it would actually be quite surprising if we did find any human, you know, remains from around this time. All right, so I'll throw it your way, Alex.
I don't know if this is going along with what you're saying or just a separate thought that I have, but one of the things that let's just say we take the ages of the people from before the flood out. Let's just say, okay, let's just take that out. Even if you look right after the flood, how old did Abraham live? Wasn't it 150 something or 160 something? It might be even close to 200.
Mm-hmm.
But and then his son lived still very old, and then it kept getting lower and lower. So you do kind of see, like what you had mentioned, this tapering off drastically after the flood, but still quite high. And I would say most, if not many, biblical scholars consider everything after Genesis, whether they believe it the beginning part of Genesis is allegory or not, they believe after the flood is historical. And so you still have, even if you take away that, you still have at least a few named persons after the flood still living longer than anyone we have recorded even today or in the close history. So
yes.
I think that's actually, it may be in a lot of ways almost a more interesting topic than even the people who are recorded as living 600, 700, 800, 900 years old.
Yeah, so this is true. Do you happen to listen to the Winsome Creationist podcast, Alex?
It's I listen to maybe one out of every 20 episodes that come out.
Okay.
Well, I'm just joking. I'm more of a fan than that, Steve.
You must have listened to a recent episode of mine. So I have another podcast that I do, a solo show called The Winsome Creationist. We actually talked about this on there recently. What was happening is a couple years ago, I was going through my Bible reading and I noticed something really, really odd. I noticed that we're way near the end of Genesis, okay? And like you just said, Alex, scholars generally regard everything from Genesis 12 onward to be historical, right? There's no, you don't get to, you know, Genesis 1 through 11, a lot of scholars, if you're not familiar with this, like to appeal to this sort of ancient mytho-history sort of idea, this notion that there was, let's just say, a lot more leeway is to be given to the authors writing Genesis 1 through 11 because they're dealing with sort of these large cosmic themes, and there's a lot of resemblance to other creation stories and other ancient sort of flood stories. And there's even like lots of other stories around the world that refer to sort of a golden age, if you will, of humanity, where people live for a really long time. Like, there's actually lots of myths and legend around this idea that sort of point to what I would call a historical core, that I would actually say that the most detailed and accurate account comes from the Bible. I'm biased in saying that, but I also have reasons for it. And so anything from Genesis 12 onward is typically considered by scholars to be normal history, okay? And so I was reading, and I came across Genesis. I want to say it is chapter 47. And I was reading in Genesis, and I think it's chapter 47. I could be wrong, but I think it's 47. And this is Jacob having a conversation with the Pharaoh of Egypt at that time, who, if you remember, Jacob's son Joseph, right? He was sort of vice pharaoh in Egypt. And so the whole thing with Joseph and his brothers happens, and Joseph is able to bring his family to stay essentially on the outskirts of Egypt. And Pharaoh's having a conversation with Jacob. And Jacob is like, yeah, I'm like, I forget exactly the age he was then. I want to say it was like 130 something. Let's just go with 130 for the sake of the argument. And he's like, yeah, I'm like 130 years old. Man, my days on earth have been full of trouble and this, that, and the other thing. And I have not even yet attained to the age of my ancestors. Now, I read that and I thought, well, no, that's interesting. So here's the dude. Genesis 47. We are well into what is highly regarded by scholars as genuine history. We're well into that. And this dude is saying that he's 130-something, which is already more than in the modern era we've had anybody live. The highest was 122, I think. So he's 130-something, and he's saying that at this point he had not yet attained to the age of his fathers. Okay, and I think I want to say he ended up living to like 150 or something like that. So when I read that, I was like, so this is interesting, very interesting sort of internal evidence for the notion that the ages of these patriarchs were real. So again, normally, and I dug into this in that episode that I won't bore you with all the details, but normally the word that's used there for fathers, it's not typically just referring to your immediate father or even your grandfather. It's referring to your family history, right? And so what we would refer to, I think, is the ancient patriarchs and even beyond that, okay? So I think there's every reason to think that in Jacob's mind, he's thinking something like, gosh, my, you know, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa lived to, you know, 673 or something like that, right? He's going back in time and he's thinking about all this and he's like, I'm not attained anywhere near that. So that's really good evidence, I think, internally in the Bible that that the ages of the patriarchs, these ancient ages, these long ages, were real, and you can't just sort of explain it away with, you know, some of these rescuing devices.
At the very least, it seems like that if those old ages were still, you know, just wildly, you know, what am I looking for? Exaggerated. At the very least, it still seems like that Jacob thought them real or took them seriously enough to believe them himself, which is at the very is worth taking him at his word.
This is a great point.
Believed it himself.
Right, because you might want to argue with that and say, oh, well, you know, this was just the biblical writer, whoever wrote that, like making sure that he was consistent in what he was saying. And I asked a lot of people about this hostile people and everything. And I was just trying to get as many different opinions as I could on this. And everybody's like, yeah, I think you're right. That honestly, the text at the very least shows that Jacob thought that his ancestors were that old. This wasn't just a literary thing. Okay. I often talk about the distinction between literary and literal. Okay. It wasn't just literary. We think that literally Jacob thought that his ancestors were this old. And so if he's wrong, then you don't have any escape from this in terms of the Bible being inerrant, right? You have to give up inerrancy if he's factually wrong about this fact. Because again, this is not just, you know, some people say, well, what's the Bible teaching versus what the Bible assumes and all this. This is pretty clear. This is pretty clear cut. This is a guy who is recording false ages, right? And he clearly believes false ages and the Bible is wrong about this. So I don't think there's any way to escape, you know, the errancy sort of problem there, which we also did an episode on errancy and inerrancy a few back. So,
which is a fun one.
Okay. So here's a few things. Yeah, it was. Here's a few things we need to go through. Okay. A few different ideas. All right. So one thing is, well, okay. So how long did they actually live? Are we saying that the Bible is like a blow by blow? Like, okay, Methuselah literally lived to 969, that specific age, right? Whatever age all the different people lived at, right? Or lived to, like, is that the specific age that's right? Okay, well, there has been lots of work done on hyperbole as a literary device. Numbers in the Bible, we talked about this in our Abimelech series that we did as well. Oftentimes, numbers in the Bible can be rounded or used for some sort of theological purpose, some sort of messaging, okay, that is intended to signal certain things. A lot of the ages end in sevens, for example, and a lot of the ages end in very round numbers. And so it's very possible, at least I'm willing to concede for my part, that maybe some of these ages that are mentioned are not precise, they're rounded. Now, rounding, in my view, is different than making up a falsehood. It's not like this guy lived to 72 and we're saying he lived to 645. Okay. Mm-hmm. That is not rounding. That's weird. That's just weird. And I don't think even on ancient standards of historical reportage, I don't think that sort of thing is acceptable. So how long did they actually live? On that point, I think I'm willing to basically say that they lived just about as long as it says in the text, give or take a few years. I think that's reasonable. I'm totally fine with ages being used to create some sort of theological idea. What's interesting is that people who, and we're going to talk more about this in a second, but people who really latched onto this idea that it was made for some sort of theological purpose, some sort of messaging. Nobody seems to know what that is. Okay. So it's possible. I mean, anything's possible, but it's not plausible. We just have no idea what this could possibly be referring to, if it is meant to signal some sort of messaging. I haven't seen anybody come out with any sort of convincing argument to that effect. So what's interesting is when you see people who make an argument for these inflated ages, you typically get two responses. One is that it's some kind of ancient number cipher of some sort. And the other is, well, look at the comparison. The closest comparison we have in ancient literature to this is the Sumerian king lists. Okay. Well, let's just dispense with those very quickly. No, okay, number one, the number cipher. We kind of already talked about this. If there is some sort of ancient number cipher, we don't have one from the ancient world. There's some that come close, but we don't have one from the ancient world that directly maps to this. And even if we did, we don't have any way to know what it means. Okay? Now, I guess you could make the argument, well, in the ancient world, they would have known what it means. Maybe. But it seems to me like there should at least be some sort of, like, some clue, right? Biblically speaking, we should be able to look within the Bible and sort of have some idea of what they were getting at. Because a lot of these ages are really random and really specific. Like, some of them do seem rounded, but then some of them are, like, really specific. And so, In the absence of a more definitive rule for that, it seems just as likely to be able to take them as literal ages. Okay, the second one, and along those same lines, is they'll say, okay, well, you know, we have these ancient king lists, like the ancient Sumerians kept these lists of their kings, and they have hugely inflated numbers. And again, it was for, they had certain purposes for it. Okay, well, a couple things here. Number one, yeah, they had inflated numbers. Their numbers were like 33,000, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Huge difference between 432, right, or whatever, and 33,000. Right? Can we just admit that, number one? Okay.
Yeah. And you would think that if the argument is that the biblical writers copied from the Sumerian writers, that they would want to equally, you know, match the ages.
One-upsmanship, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, think about this. That's actually a good segue into the second point of that, which is that why were those ancient king lists written that way? Well, one thing you're going to find is that these ancient king lists, what they typically did was detailed. We've talked about this before. They detailed victories, right? That's what they did. They were militaristic propaganda is what they were. It was Nazi stuff. I mean, literally, that's what this stuff was, right? The point is to make these guys seem otherworldly, right? To divinize them, to royalize them, to give them these sort of grand ideas. And they really did. They actually viewed these kings as being essentially like Pharaoh was like essentially the agent, the underling of the sun god, right? In Egyptian mythology, right? So, I mean, literally, Pharaoh was the image of God. That's literally. Pharaoh was the image of God. Yeah. Like, we are the image of God. Humans are the image of Yahweh God. Pharaoh, there was only one. Pharaoh was the image of the sun god. So the idea is that these ancient kings are like, again, these divinized sort of rulers, that were powered by the gods. And so, yeah, we're going to give them these huge inflated ages, and we're going to only talk about the battles that they won. And so that's the Sumerian king list. Okay, we just don't have anything like that in the biblical genealogies. We have no correlation. There's no special anything there that's going on. No gamesmanship that we can see, no number cipher that maps to anything meaningful that gives us any sort of meaning. So are the ages real? Well, they're pretty close.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much to add except I agree with it and following with what you're saying. It's one of those things, like kind of what you said at the beginning. It's there's no reason for you not to take the Bible, you know, what it seems to be is at its word and based on everything that we've said so far. And then like what you said, there's also no evidence that fully proves it. So it is one of those things where it comes at the end of the day and you're like, well, it's what I believe, because it's what I believe, that's what the scripture's saying. And I guess what I'm saying is it is very logical to think that way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 All right. So let me give you a couple more things here and then we'll sort of wrap it up. And we might get through this one a little bit quicker than some of the other ones. Hey, that's amazing, right? All right. So let me give you what I think is two sort of positive cases for this. And then I'm going to talk about sort of how this is like some theories that have gone on, you know, in recent or in the past about how this is actually possible from a couple different angles. Okay, so one thing is, the first piece of the positive case is that these are what have been referred to by many as chronogenealogies, okay? So when I say these, okay, the genealogies that are being mentioned here that are talking about the people who have lived so long are Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, okay? These are chronogenealogies because they give you specific information about how old a person was when their son was born and how many more years they lived until they died. And so what you end up with is a actually very tight accounting of Earth history. The first person to sort of really crystallize this into mainstream thinking, Christian thinking, was Archbishop Usher, right? James Usher. And he sort of classically came up with a date for creation, which is like was like in October of 4004 BC. Okay. Well, we obviously don't have to be so precise as Bishop Usher, okay? But
it might have been in November.
It might have been in November, right? But the point that he was making is that these genealogies give us concrete historical information. Timing. They give us timing. They give us chronological information. And this is interesting for two reasons. Reason number one is there is literally in ancient literature no other genealogy like Genesis 5 and Genesis 11. These are unique. There are no other correlations like them. And this is a really important point because a lot of times, I can't tell you how many times I've heard the argument from other biblical scholars, well-meaning and very knowledgeable, who basically make an argument, it's actually a logical fallacy, but we won't go into all of that, who basically make the argument, oh, well, this genealogy over here in Matthew clearly skips generations. Therefore, this genealogy in Genesis 11 could also skip generations. And of course, the question is not, well, could it, but did it, right? And when you actually run the math on that, with the data in the genealogies themselves, you would have to add 300, like if you even added, I think 300 missing generations, that's a lot. A generation is like, you know, a long time. So if you added 300 missing generations, the most that you would get for that time period is 10,000 years. Okay. That's not a lot of time in the grand scale of Earth history if you're an old Earth creationist. And I'm going to get to the creation back and forth in just a minute, but I don't want to camp there too long. So except to say that the ages of the patriarchs are a challenge for old age views. And so most often you will hear people who want to affirm an old age view take issue with these ages, especially because they accept evolutionary history, which in general would negate the fact that we've ever had a human being live that long on Earth, but especially not that long ago. Okay. So these are chronogenealogies, and they give us, they're the only two genealogies in ancient literature at all that give us this sort of precise chronological information that you could actually build a chronology from these genealogies. They're the only ones that exist. So that's kind of weird, right? Like, talk about your genealogy having a purpose. Okay. Well, that gives us a purpose. And it's like, it's so obvious that it's like, why is it like that if not meant for us to connect those dots? Like, it seems like that's why it's there. And that's sort of my second point about the chronogenealogy is that these are the only time, these genealogies bridge the only gaps in the entire biblical record of Earth history for which we would not otherwise have a time referent, right? So we know from Abraham to the time of Christ, it's about 2,000 years. And we know from the time of Christ to today, it's about 2,000 years. Okay, because of the genealogies, we also know that between the time of creation and Abraham was about 2,000 years, okay? And we would not know that if not for these genealogies. And so it's the only spot in biblical history where we have no other way to know what the time frame was, but these genealogies give it to us. And they're the only genealogies in ancient literature that have this kind of information in it. And it's very, very specific. So I think that's a really, really good argument for the fact that these genealogies are talking about accurate ages. Thoughts? Any?
I hope I can ask this thought clearly because it just popped in my head. And I'm sure there's an answer for this, but I haven't thought about it until now. But so you have Moses writing Genesis. And how do I want to ask this? So it seems odd to me that, and again, maybe someone who knows history a little bit better than me can answer this, but it seems odd to me that there's no kind of like ramp up in like a language or some sort of explanation for the history of mankind. It just seems like all of a sudden you have, and I know that there might be earlier writings, but you have Moses just writing a full book on the history of the history of humankind. I don't know. It just seems like weird that there would just be a random ramp up and then, you know, over thousands of years. And then all of a sudden man just kind of comes up with it. It just seems more natural or more of a clear explanation where it makes sense that it got passed down generation to generation.
Yeah.
And this is how like we understand the things. Does that make sense?
It does. Right. Yeah, it does. And look, there's so many ideas here. Like, so just to give you a quick sketch of the landscape, right? Lots of opinions on Genesis. Did Moses write it? Is there, you know, is it something more like the modern JEPD theory? Is it something like the supplementarian theory of days gone by, which is the fact that, well, Moses basically wrote Genesis, but that along the way after him, there were those who also came back in and edited the text. And under the inspiration of God, essentially, you know, making scribal updates and things like that. I'm not going to lie. I tend to lean towards that view that the Pentateuch is written primarily by Moses. And then there are scribal updates under the inspiration and authority of God that happened. I think that's pretty clear, from an honest assessment, of the text. And so there's that piece of it, but then there's also been these theories floated around PJ Wiseman? I don't know. That kind of sounds familiar. I think that might be the guy's name. I could be totally wrong. But I want to say it might be PJ Wiseman, who had something called the tablet theory, which was popular for a long time. And that was this idea essentially that the Toledotes, so in the generations of, you know, where you have sort of these headings for various sections in Genesis that are written, people have argued over the years that those were actually written on tablets, each of those by that actual person. So, you know, these are the generations of Noah, right? That's actually Noah writing like his part. And then essentially Moses is sort of collating all that together at when he's writing and taking their ideas and putting them together. There's an idea. And then of course there's the idea that, this is some combination of Moses writing from memory / a download from God of sorts, or just oral tradition, right? Oral tradition that had been passed down through the Hebrew people and then Moses writing from that. I think something like that is what's going on.
But you have a lot of options.
Yeah, you do. And of course, then there are people who totally throw out biblical history and say, well, yeah, the ancient Chinese dynasties are like 30,000 years old. So what do you do with those? Or like the Australian Aborigines, right? And so, again, you have to look at those things. And of course, I think that they would have to fit somewhere underneath of a young age creationist framework. Spoiler alert, I'm a young age creationist. And so that's the view I take. And so I have to explain those things. in my paradigm. But yeah, there would be some that would say, well, you're right, Alex, it's ridiculous to think that this is what happened, because it's not what happened. There was, we have writing, and but we do legitimately only have writing for about the last 6,000 years, right? So that's exactly. That is sort of another interesting thing, right? That it's like, oh, it actually kind of matches the you know, that time scale. All right, so another, and I'll keep this one really brief here, but the other argument, other than the fact that these are chronogenealogies that we can glean time information from, is the fact that this really does seem to be a closed genealogy instead of an open genealogy. And basically that just means a closed genealogy is one that cannot have significant gaps of time inserted. And how would those gaps of time get inserted? Well, by skipped generations. So like maybe it says that this person was this other person's father, but actually it was their grandfather or their great grandfather or something like that. And again, I actually have a blog post on my website about the genealogies in Genesis. So if you go to steveschramm.com and search for genealogy, you're going to find this article. There have been many writers who've taken this to task and shown that because you have certain people, like it explicitly shows where certain fathers like named their sons. So if that father named their son, then you can't put generations in between there. That's actually the father-son relationship. And again, all of that math has already been done and been shown that you can only add about 300 missing generations, maybe in the places where they could be added. And if you did that, you'd only get about 10,000 years, and you need a lot more than that to make a longer period of Earth history. So suffice it to say, all the evidence points to these being closed genealogies and not open genealogies. And I think if you have a closed genealogy that gives chronological information at the beginning of time, exactly where you need it, and is the only one like it in all of ancient history, then the genealogy is probably there for a purpose. It says these ages for a purpose, and it's probably accurate too. And then with all the evidence that we put together that we talked about already with Jacob and all of that stuff, I think it's very clear that these were the actual ages. Okay, now that leaves us in a really uncomfortable place, Alex. If we cut it off right here, we'd be in a lot of danger, because we have a Bible telling us that people have lived to 960-something years old. And all in between. We don't have any evidence that's true. We kind of opened up with that. So what do we do? What do we do with that? So a natural question is...
We think of theories.
We do. Well, we do. Yes. A natural question is, how is this possible? And I don't know how it's possible. I've already made the point that we wouldn't necessarily expect to find evidence of it. And I understand that might sound or feel like special pleading to some people. I get that. It's true nonetheless, okay, that if the flood narrative is true and it all ties in with the genealogies and everything and all was happening at the same time, if the flood narrative is true, I would not expect that we would find a being that old. Same, by the way, as I would not expect to find evidence of giants necessarily, right? Oh, well, if a flood came and killed all these giants, like, why aren't there any? Because, again, I would not expect to find evidence of giants. And this is why whenever people come with their giant evidence, they've got these pictures of things that have obviously been faked and falsified. I'm not buying it, right? And it's for the same reason. It is that we wouldn't expect to find giants. It's actually a positive, you know, you can make that case in a positive light. I wouldn't expect to find giants. So, you know, this photo that you found is an obvious forgery. And then when it actually the work is done and it's shown that they are forgeries, it's like, well, I told you so, right? So I wouldn't expect to find them. So that's fine. So a couple other things. So the genetic bottleneck, right? One thing that this actually helps sort of explain is the decline in ages. So I'm always looking at the Bible and thinking, well, is it consistent with itself, right? That's important. It's important for the Bible to be sort of consistent with itself, right? Yeah. And so, scientifically speaking, the Bible is not a scientific textbook. But if you had someone, if you had people somewhat normally living to 900 and something years old, right? 900 years old. And then you had a genetic bottleneck event, like a flood, where the entire population was reduced to 8 people. You are dramatically cutting down, I'm just going to use the term, the genetic possibilities of that people, of those people to to manifest and to spread, drastically cutting down the genetic possibilities. And so it is 100% scientifically accurate and expected for a genetic bottleneck event like that to gradually reduce the ages of the people who live after it. It is literally to the it's exactly how it would happen. And that's what we have in the Bible, right? We don't see this immediate cutoff. There's some disagreement, by the way, to the idea, because it says in the Bible that before the flood comes, it says that his days, when God is talking to Noah about how he's going to judge the earth, it says that his days, man's days, will be limited to 120 years. Okay. There's disagreement about what that means. If it does mean, as many think, the fact that, yep, there's basically a ceiling now on how old a human can live. It's really interesting that we've sort of had this genetic bottleneck degradation to the fact that now, again, in modern history, the only person, you know, the highest age living person has topped out at like 122 years old. And again, that 120 number not being for the purposes of it being exactly precise, but about that long, right? You can live to about 120 years old, right? That's sort of the idea. So that's kind of fascinating. The genetic bottleneck seems to have happened. And by the way, there's also other things in the Bible that make sense and it's consistent. So a lot of times we get the question, where did Cain get his wife, right? How did Cain have a wife? Because Cain and Abel and all that, like, it was only Adam and Eve's kids, right? Well, it says that Adam and Eve had plenty of other sons and daughters also. And the fact of the matter is that Cain married his sister. And you're like, oh, but the Bible prevents that. It does in the law thousands of years later when the genetic bottleneck, after the genetic bottleneck had happened to where it would be dangerous to interbreed. So yes, interbreeding, marrying your sister or your cousin or whatever, is forbidden by Jewish law, which makes sense because the genetic population would not have been able to handle it. It would lead to health problems and mental illness and sickness, okay? It would not have if you got the entire human race genetically preloaded in Adam and Eve and then their offspring. Again, you have to understand that that's what's happening is they were genetically preloaded with all of this. And that makes perfect sense. Be fine, marry their family because that's all they have. That's why we're all related, right? One way or another, okay? And which is consistent for salvation history and everything too. We're all from one blood. That's Paul in Acts 17. Lots of stuff there. That's why racism is wrong. Again, so many things we could go into. But the idea is genetically preloaded at the beginning. Cain marries his sister. It's totally fine. We have this bottleneck event exactly as expected. Population of humanity seems to dwindle down. Then, also as expected, God goes ahead and prohibits that kind of thing from happening because it is not healthy for humans to do that and to be breeding that closely together. So the whole biblical storyline with the genetic bottleneck is consistent. So that's not explaining, hey, this is how this is possible, but it's saying that, well, human history has played out pretty much exactly how it would need to if this were the case. And I think it's quite a feat that the Bible sort of seems to get all that right. Okay?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think that that's one thing is someone might look at this and say, well, that sounds kind of crazy. We don't have any evidence of someone living that long. I can't believe you believe that if that is what you do believe. But again, no one knows 100% anyway of what happened. When I say no, I mean like actually have evidence written on a wall or in a book. You can say, oh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
And so if you have that consistency factor, you can say, well, at least I'm consistent in it. And it follows through that my worldview makes sense, at least, if that were to happen.
That's correct. And think about how many other things. So, right, there's this medical analogy. If you hear hoof prints, think horse, not zebra. Okay. What that means is the simplest explanation is usually the right one. Okay. Think about how many things you have to explain away that if you leave this framework, right? This is a very consistent framework that I've just laid out for you here. If you leave this framework and the numbers are not real, they don't mean anything, now you have a lot more questions to answer, okay? And probably more than I could even think of, but like a few are now you have to have a different answer for the Cain's wife thing because that doesn't necessarily make sense. You have to explain away why the Jewish calendar is only 5,000 or so, you know, something years into its history. You have to explain that. You have to explain why the genetic degradation happened or why the ages gradually go down what would be the reason for that other than some sort of theological messaging if it's not just the reality of how it happened and there's no scientific thing to map it back? So you see, there's a lot of things now that you have to sort of explain individually, and maybe you can individually explain all those things away. But boy, it sure does make a lot more sense if you just say, oh, well, if the text actually means what it says, then all of these things are not only explained, but they cohere. They're in a consistent framework. That matters. And that coherence itself, it's called, in the scientific world, it's called consilience. That itself is actually a piece of evidence. The fact that all the data coheres right, and is 100%. Logically consistent is a piece of evidence. Here's another thing in terms of the how is this possible. A lot of people used to make the argument that the canopy theory would explain this. And so if you're not familiar, the canopy theory was this idea that the firmament in Genesis 1 was a hard dome, a hard canopy of some kind. Either there have actually been, especially a couple of views on this, right? So back in the day, the two popular ones were that it was sort of a hard ice canopy. And then there was another view that it was a water vapor canopy that would essentially form some sort of like a greenhouse effect. And that would have allegedly enabled human beings to live those inflated ages. Well, that theory has been out the window for quite some time. Lots of biblical scholars don't believe that it was any kind of a hard substance that makes up the firmament in Genesis 2. They believe it's the expanse of the sky, and many of our translations render the words that way. To be clear, there's actually been a resurgence in Hebrew scholarship of a lot of modern day Hebrew scholars think that the Bible does teach that there's a solid dome over the earth, or at least that's what the ancient Israelites believed, and so that's the thought that's in the Bible. But then it's not what the Bible is actually teaching about our world, right? So they're not saying that we're flat earth, you know, that the world is flat and that there's a dome over the sky, but they're saying that that's what the ancient Hebrews believed, right? I disagree with that take personally, but it is interesting that modern Hebrew scholarship is sort of latching onto this idea that, ironically, fundamentalist creationists, right, used to have back in the day. And so the short answer for why the vapor canopy theory and the ice canopy theory and all that, those theories sort of went out the window because the amount of heat from the sun in those scenarios would have literally burned up the planet. So it's just not feasible to hold that belief. And so even if it was possible that that sort of facilitated these long ages, since everything would have been dead and burned up, it doesn't really seem like a good explanation. So
not a paradise.
Yeah. Not a paradise. That is for sure. An interesting take on this is the old Earth creationist Hugh Ross. Now, I'm gonna be in a nice way mean for like 30 seconds. Okay, put a timer on me here, but I'm gonna be mean for about 30 seconds. Unfortunately, progressive creationism, old Earth Hugh Ross-esque creationism, it was really popular in the 90s and leading up into the early 2000s, and it became really popular around 2015, 2016. And then it just started falling off and dropping off dramatically because it is so nuanced on some of these specifics and trying to explain things away that it's just really incredible. And there's only been one or two that I'm aware of Hebrew scholars who have actually endorsed these ideas. One of the things that Hugh Ross likes to do is say, so he takes issue with the fact that that there was Homo sapien human death before the fall, but he's okay with there being animal death before the fall. Never mind the fact that Genesis 1, 29, and 30 literally puts human death and animal death right next to each other and suggests very strongly that both humans and animals pre-fall were vegetarian. Okay? Dr. Ross says, well, animals have always been carnivorous. They've always been carnivorous animals. And so carnivory has been happening since day one. God built death into the cycle of creation in that sense. But we know that humans were vegetarian in the early chapters of Genesis. We know that when the earth was first created and that humanity was first created, we know that humans were vegetarian. And the reason why we know this is because you can't live to 900 years old on a carnivore diet. Okay, a carnivore can't, this is his argument, a carnivore can't live to that old So we know they ate plants. We know they were vegetarian and they did not eat meat. And so, I mean, never mind, again, the special pleading between like, well, why does it apply to the humans but not to the animals when they're literally back to back in Genesis 1? That's a important point. But so this is Dr. Ross's attempt at how this is possible, right? Is that we know that humans were a vegetarian, right? And so again, that he says it this way, that he uses that nuance because it allows him to take these ages fairly literally and still have a nuanced definition of humanity that sort of fits with his old age creationist desires, right? And his want to go there. So just throwing that out there as the alternative that he mentions. Honestly, the answer to the how it's possible question for me is just a really simple one. It's what the Bible's already said, right? If it's true that Adam and Eve are the first humans, if they are the first pair of actual humans, they were endowed with the image of God, given everything else that we just talked about, then we know that Adam and Eve were endowed with the purest form of human DNA. They were endowed with a perfect line of DNA, everything in them needed to make and to actually accomplish. Again, this is where the Bible is consistent. What was their goal? What was their entire goal? God gave them, we call it the dominion mandate. He said, be fruitful and multiply, right? The point is, have lots of kids, right? That's what they were supposed to do. So God preloads them with the genetic DNA of all of humanity so that they can do the job of having lots of kids. That would absolutely, especially if you think about the original creation, if you're like me and you believe that the original creation was, the word perfect is loaded, but it was very good according to the Bible. It was set out to accomplish the purposes that God had for it. It was a very good world. It's hard to imagine death, suffering, cancer, thorns, disease, sickness, illness, and all of that in God's very good world. It's really hard to imagine that for me from a Christian theological standpoint. And so in that haven, in that utopia, if you will, in that world where you've got two humans, the first humans, and they were preloaded with all this genetic diversity, it's 100% the logical deduction that you would have humans living to a very, very long time. And as the effects of sin started to take over more and more of the world as a result of the curse on the ground, and then the flood comes and you have that genetic bottleneck event, then you have this degradation in the human genome all the way down. It absolutely makes sense that we are where we are today and we started where we did back then, according to Genesis. So I think the explanation is just that they were preloaded with the genetic diversity that would absolutely lead to that natural result, especially in the world that God had given them to live in and the mission that God had given them to do. I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that you'd have humans living to hundreds of years old, and then after the flood, you would gradually see that decline. So I think the answer is built into the Bible.
I remember, I don't know how young, I don't know if I was high school or college or even before then, but I remember thinking like just that's the answer. Like I remember coming up on like these issues and stuff and just saying, well, it would just make sense if the biblical account of what I'm thinking it to be is true, then it would make sense that the first humans were kind of pure in a sense. And then just over time, it just kind of deteriorates, whether it's DNA, whether it's through mutations, whether it's just, you know, mating. And it would just make sense for it to kind of deteriorate over time. Like we used to the bottleneck of after the flood. And again, it just kind of goes to the consistency factor where you might think that that sounds crazy that if someone believes that, but at the same time, it's consistent. And if the world really did behave that way, if that's how it got its start, then that's a very believable way for it to all have happened.
That's correct. I mean, you hardly have to read about this in apologetics, in an apologetics book for it to make sense, right? You just think for a minute and it's like, oh, well, yeah, that would make sense. And then when you have the scientists who look at it and say, that does make sense. That certainly helps. But like, again, there's a reason why this has been the Christian view. And I know that that's going to put me at odds with probably a lot of people who listen to this podcast. I mean, my guess is that the majority of people who find this podcast and who are regular listeners are not going to agree with me on creation. And by the way, that's totally okay. That's why my other podcast is called The Winsome Creationist. Okay. I'm the creationist who's actually nice. But like, when you just look at the biblical statements, if they do mean what they say, then you have a lot of consistency. And I know you want to say something, but let me just harp on that for like just 2 seconds, okay? Let me just give it probably one of the most common examples of where someone says, well, as a creationist, no, you're actually not consistent, right? They make these statements about how Genesis 1 talks about how there was light, right? There was days before the fourth day, and the fourth day is when the sun was created, right? And so you have this idea of the fact that you can't have days without the sun. And so you, creationists, are actually being inconsistent with the Bible, because somehow there's these days that you're saying are ordinary solar days, but then there's no sun until day four. So how do you do that? Okay. Well, we don't measure our days by the sun. Okay. There are lots of places in the world, Alaska, right, that go through periods of darkness for months at a time. We don't measure our days by the sun. We measure our days by the rotation of the earth. Okay. And you do, in order to actually like have the effects of a day on planet Earth, you need to have a directional light source and you need to have a rotating earth. Okay. We have all of those things before day four in Genesis, right? It says that God made the light. And then there we, right in the beginning, he said there was light. Let there be light, right? So we had light and we had planet Earth. So therefore we could have days. Now, if we're just taking the text at face value, yeah, we now have a sun on day four. And arguably this light source would be a specific light source for the purpose of signs and for seasons and for days and for years, right? For marking time for a human to understand. That's what the purpose of the sun in day four is. I'm open to the suggestion that the light source in for the first 3 days is the sun and the same as the fourth day. And it is simply mentioned on the fourth day as a polemic against the fact that against the other ancient cultures who worship the sun as a god, right? I'm willing to say that that's a polemic shot. And in fact, the sun is not even named. It's just called the greater light. And the moon was also worshipped. And it's not called the moon in Genesis 1. It's called the lesser light. So you have the greater light and the lesser light. So I'm willing to say there's some theological stuff going on there. But the point is that if you point out that inconsistency, you haven't, and you say you're being inconsistent with the Bible. I'm not. Actually, you're importing science. So many people have missed this point. That's why I'm actually using this as an illustration. You're actually importing science. You're saying I'm being inconsistent with science, but I'm claiming I'm being consistent with scripture. I don't care what science says about what you need to make a day necessarily. Right? I mean, I do, but I don't. And the reality is that scripturally speaking, we have all the ingredients that we need for a day all the way through creation week, right? And so there's this temptation to say, hey, creationists, you're actually not being very consistent with scripture. Almost all cases, I hear that point made. Somebody is actually unknowingly, it's so subtle, but they're unknowingly pointing to something beyond scripture to make that point. So I actually think as a creationist, I have the eminently consistent position when it comes to looking at the text of scripture. And I mean, if I didn't think that, I wouldn't be a creationist. So anyway.
Interesting. The one main important question here is which kind of view of all this do you have to have in order to get through the pearly gates at the end of your life?
Well, to quote Alistair Begg, I will say that the only reason that I am going to be welcomed through those gates is because the man on the middle cross said, I can come. That's it. That is the only reason.
Oh, so that's the reason why. Okay.
That is gotcha. The only reason. I am sure. I cannot wait to get to heaven and find out what all I was wrong about, right? I can't wait. I am that way. I just can't wait. I'm sure I'm wrong about a lot of things. I'm doing my best to accurately present the different positions because I am in a position of teaching other people in many different contexts. So I want to be careful about that, but I also have my opinions and I can't wait to see what I'm wrong about.
Yeah, it's funny. When it comes to the Genesis account, I have some fairly strong opinions, but then other light opinions, usually leaning towards a young creationist perspective. But then at the same time, I totally wouldn't be surprised if one day it's explained to me by God himself. Oh no, it actually is old and here's how that works.
Right,
and
yeah.
I'd be like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. What are you gonna do?
It's one of
say
those things
God,
where it's like, okay,
wrong,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're not, right.
You're not gonna tell him he was wrong, right? So
yeah, it's one of these fun things that is just really fun to go through.
So the big question here we are, Alex, at an hour again, right? But the big question is, what have we spent the last hour talking about? Why does this matter? And what I wrote down is simply like, the idea we've kind of hit on it the whole time about the consistency, but it's just having an accurate account of Earth history. And taking biblical statements seriously, right? I take the text seriously when it says that there are these people who lived for this amount of time and that so-and-so bore so-and-so and they named him and he lived this long after he was born. And I take all those things seriously. And you might say, oh, Steve, well, do you take it seriously when it says that Jesus is the door? Well, obviously, obviously I do, because what he means there is not that he's a physical door. It means he is the door of salvation. And there's actually a reference there to sort of like the I think it was the sheep gate, right? In sort of the ancient world. That there's actually something that would be a reference to that, that the ancient people would have understood. So yes, I don't believe in this hyper wooden literalism idea. I believe that you take a text as it was written and as it was meant to be written and conveyed, and you read it that way. I just think in this case that these are texts that are meant to be read as being fairly accurate, literal, like understanding of how Earth history went. And I think that matters. I think we should desire to be consistent and to be biblical and to deal with the implications of that, whatever they may be, even if they are uncomfortable in the halls of academia in some places. So,
well said, Steve. Well said.
Cool.
Well, we could stretch this out another 3 minutes to go to an hour, but I guess we can cut it here.
Let's cut it here. Please share this podcast with others. It's the only way it'll spread, ultimately, is if you tell other people about it. We'd love to get more audio. So on the audio side, if you do happen to listen to this on audio, please consider going over to Apple Podcasts and leaving a review for us there, because that,
100%.
That's a big thing. It doesn't like help us get boosted up in the rankings or anything, but it helps other people when they do stumble across the podcast say, oh man, this thing's got hundreds of ratings and all these people left comments about it. I got to see what this podcast is about.
People love Steve. This guy, Steve, on there.
No, lies. Lies. Why didn't he let that Alex guy talk more? That's what they would say. And I say, if he would talk more, I'd let him.
Fair point.
But please do share it with others and leave those reviews. And those would really, really help us. And we'd be honored if you'd do that. So thanks for hanging out with us.
Perfect. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.